Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
Fried fam, you know that my background, if you've been around here, if you're new, you might not know this, but my background is in healthcare. I have a master's degree in Chinese medicine. I have done over 30,000 acupuncture treatments around the world. I had practices in New York City, Prague, and Warsaw. So I spent the majority of my career in a patient-facing role doing one-on-one patient work. And yet, you have not heard me say a lot of things about burnout in healthcare for a few reasons. Number one, I never worked within the traditional healthcare system. As an acupuncturist, I owned my own businesses. I worked within a fertility center for 4 years, but that was in Poland and the rules were totally different. That's the beginning, right? So I don't have that intimate knowledge of doing that. And the second reason is because I have been at the edge of being hired for multiple healthcare-based events that decided that they would not hire me because my master's degree in Chinese medicine wasn't valid enough for me to provide CEUs for the participants. So I have pulled myself out of the healthcare space. I don't talk about it a lot. It's not something that we talk about a lot on Fried, but today we're going to dive all the way into it because we're going to be talking to Dr. Zaria Rubin, who is a Harvard-educated neurologist and functional physician who helps high-achieving women, doctors, and the such in midlife break free from burnout to reclaim their passion, purpose, and joy for medicine. She is also the host of the Outsmart Burnout podcast, which I was on recently. So I'm super excited to introduce you to Dr. Zaria.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I am so excited to talk with you and to really dive into this topic that is so important and continues to be so relevant, more so every year.
So just before we hit record, you were like, I have so many pages of notes. I have so many things that I need to talk about. So many things came up since we spoke last, because the last time we spoke, we said, well, what are we going to talk about on Friday? How are we going to use your knowledge and your experience to really hit a different note than we've hit in the past on this podcast? And we decided to get this from a healthcare angle. So instead of me asking you a first question, what I want to ask is, when you were putting together all those pages of notes, what was something that you were like, if I don't talk about this on Friday, I will like die?
Yeah. I mean, how much time do we have on this podcast?
Because about 45 minutes. So
okay,
just start rolling.
We can do it. We'll do it. So obviously, whenever I talk about burnout in healthcare, I talk about my own story because I was a physician, a very high achieving person who had, you know, hit all the milestones and all the gold stars, all the accolades and Ivy League education, check, 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 was supposedly succeeding, you know, at the speed of light, and then really burned out spectacularly. So I love sharing my own story, and I think it's relevant and it's interesting, and we can dive into that. But I also think that the concept of burnout in medicine is so nuanced and perhaps somewhat different than the concept of burnout writ large in other fields and in other professions, even because of sort of two other concepts that come into play, being compassion fatigue and moral injury. Yeah. You know where I'm going. And so I think that those pieces intersect, they all intersect to create this perfect storm, if you will, for burnout. I mean, the nature of the job itself is makes one prone to burnout. The nature of the people who are attracted to the career and who choose to go into medicine were primed for burnout. But when you add it all together and then you add the nature of practicing medicine in the US in 2026 with all that that entails, that is a recipe for burnout. Of course, we had the pandemic, and that's a whole other story. And that's when burnout rates skyrocketed, but they haven't really come back down to pre-pandemic levels, which shows to me that the pandemic didn't cause burnout in medicine. It just sort of unmasked it and revealed all of the inadequacies and weaknesses in the system.
All right, so
Yeah.
let's jump into those two topics first, because not everybody knows what they mean. And as we do that, if there are parts of your story that relate to them, that would be helpful in explaining them,
Oh,
and we'll
sure.
jump into that in that way.
Yeah.
So let's dive into the concept of compassion fatigue first.
Yeah. So that's a really, it's a really tricky one and a really interesting one. And I think it does tie into some of the fundamentals of burnout, you know, the fundamental pillars of burnout, which I'm sure you've covered on your show a million times, you know, the exhaustion, the crushing fatigue, and then the cynicism aspect. And so compassion fatigue really refers to the concept of you're overgiving and overcaring. And the end result of that is not that you become more empathic and more caring, is that you start to develop resentment and fatigue for the people you're supposed to be caring for the most. And so we see this actually in the healthcare professions, any kind of caring profession. We also see it in the military. Anytime you're supposed to be protecting people or helping people, and then you're exposed to so much trauma and grief, and you are asked to give everything you have, and you have not much to give, then you start to resent those people for whom you're supposed to be caring. And then the guilt and the shame start to creep in as well. And that's when you hear all of the sort of the gallows humor that you hear in medicine. And I'm sure, you know, if you watch any television show, you hear doctors, you know, making jokes about patients. If you've ever read the book House of God, my goodness, like the way they talk about patients is very dehumanizing. It's very cynical, and it is in some ways a self-protection mechanism because you are so burned out on compassion.
Yeah, so this happened to me. This was part of my burnout story. I remember getting to the point where, I was working in fertility at the time. And so I was helping people through this really incredibly difficult portion of their lives. And I got to the point where, and I always feel awful admitting this, but I feel like saying it out loud can help people sometimes. But I started to not care if people got pregnant. The only reason that it was important to me that one of my patients was, had a successful transfer or got pregnant naturally after 6 years of trying with Western medicine or whatever it happened to be, the only reason I cared was because it meant that they were going to be off my schedule soon.
I was going to say they would leave your practice and you'd have one less person to have to try to help.
Yeah. And I
Yeah.
had a big waiting list, so it was like a relief when I could finally bring somebody in because a spot opened up. So I got that, and I stopped being able to match their joy when it happened because of the disappointment when it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really crushing. And when, you know, in medicine, you're exposed to so much trauma and so much grief and so much death that you start to become numb to it. And in fact, you're almost trained
I was
to
just going to
become
say,
numb to it.
that was my next question, right? But because you are trained to keep yourself separate to a degree as much as you can, but is that even, is it truly, it's like, come on.
Well, so for me, there was a massive red flag that actually showed up during my first week of medical school. And of course, you are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And when you arrive in medical school, I mean, you are living the dream. It's like the culmination of all of the years of studying and your MCATs and all of the work that you've done. I mean, it's finally paid off. You're finally here. You made it. You've arrived. And in fact, a lot of the data shows us that when medical students arrive in med school, they have lower burnout rates than age-matched peers. I mean, it's like 2%. And then that quickly skyrockets within a couple of months. It's up to like in the 50s and 60s. And so we are just, breaking these students. But so I arrive, and first thing, what do you do first week of medical school? Well, aside from all of the orientation week, partying and doing tequila shots, you come face to face with a dead body. And so you go to the anatomy lab and you meet your cadaver, and you're going to have an intimate relationship with this
For an entire semester.
for an entire semester. And it's, my colleagues, my classmates were beyond excited that they get this opportunity, and they get to dive in, and they get to dissect, and they
I
get to, oh my
love
God, we're going to
cadaver
get
lab.
to fuck. Oh my
Cadaver
God.
lab was my favorite class.
Well, let me tell you about this girl, and it was kind of like, you're at the beginning of the horror movie, and you get to the scary mansion, and there's like cobwebs and spooky music, and you think like, don't go in there, but you go in there. So I'm sitting in the anatomy lab, and all my classmates are super excited, and the professor's lecturing to us and telling us, how the what the process is like, and these people make a donation to science, and it's all great, and this and that. And all I can do is stare at this dead body in front of me that has some tattoos. And I start thinking about the person and who this person is and was, and what they meant to people in their lives. And I start sobbing, like not just like tearing up a bit, but sobbing. Because I am a massive, massive empath. And I thought that was going to be an excellent quality for becoming a physician. But in fact, it was a massive liability. So we get to the end of the lecture, and I'm a mess. And everyone else is like raring to go and like, where are the scalpels? And the professor pulls me aside, takes me out of the lab, and says to me, "Did you have a recent death in your family?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you might want to consider an alternate career path."
Wow.
And I said, "Oh, you just got me to double down." Like internally, I said, "Oh, I ain't quitting now. You think I can't do it? Watch me." And so that lit a fire in me to prove everyone wrong, because a nice Jewish girl from a family who said, "Please don't go into medicine. We don't think it's the right fit for you." And I was like, "Oh, you don't know. I'm going to show you all. I'm going to prove everyone wrong." So with that massive chip on my shoulder, I slogged through 4 years of pre-med, 4 years of medical school, 5 years of residency, 2 years of fellowship before completely crashing and burning.
I think this is, we're going to get into the moral injury in a moment, but I think this is a piece that you just touched upon sort of indirectly that I think is really important that we sort of gloss over pretty frequently. And that piece is those sunk cost fallacy, right? This idea that right now, you are a keynote speaker and you are a coach for physician, especially female physicians who are burnt out. And so you have this like really fulfilling world that you now enter, but it's not as quote unquote prestigious as what you left behind. It doesn't come with the same level of clout or the same respect from people. It just doesn't. And you went through all of that schooling and spent all of that money and all of that time and all of that energy and all of that so that you could, in part, somewhere subconsciously, so that you could, in part, own that title that granted you that respect and that this and that this and that this. And then you burn out and you make a step to walk away, to move away from it. What does that do to your identity? And is this something that is preventing a lot of people from understanding that where they ended up is not actually a match for them. Just like your family said, like this, we don't think this is a fit. Like
Oh,
people staying
absolutely.
stuck because of an identity crisis.
Absolutely. Because medicine was not a job for me. It wasn't a career for me. It was a calling. It was what I believed to be my true calling and my true identity. And it was so wrapped up in who I was that I couldn't even process or fathom, who am I going to be now? Like, I had been determined to be a doctor since I was 5 years old. I had a lot of medical trauma as a child. Let me give your listeners another pro tip. Trauma is not a solid foundation for choosing a career path.
Most of us are using it anyway, but
Yes, it is also a surefire way to burn out. But I got to the point where I was going through the motions. I was so physically, emotionally, mentally depleted. My mental health was really hanging by a thread. I mean, I would go to work every morning. I worked in New York City in Washington Heights, and I would stand on the subway platform waiting for that A train. And I'd wait for the train and I'd see the light, and the train would be coming into the tunnel, pulling into the station. And I would joke to myself, today, should I get on the train or should I jump in front of it? And I mean, that's not funny.
No,
That's
I did the same thing when I was burnt
crisis.
out.
It's a mental health crisis. And we know that physician burnout and physician suicide are huge
Shout out to the
problems.
Lorna Brown Foundation. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but that wasn't enough of a wake-up call
Yeah.
to get me to leave. I thought my mental health was sort of expendable. It was sort of an afterthought. And because of that sunk cost fallacy as well, I was like, well, I can't leave. I mean, what am I going to do? I can't. Nobody quits medicine. I mean, no one quits their dream job, even though it was a nightmare. And it took a really extreme wake-up call that came in the form of a literal phone call from my best friend from medical school one night saying that her husband, who was our age, mid-30s, young, healthy, had collapsed while playing frisbee. And they had rushed him to the hospital and tried to resuscitate him. And I said, well, but he's okay now. And she said, no, he didn't make it. And that hit me like a ton of bricks. The shock, the grief, like my entire life and my own mortality flashed before my eyes. Like, oh, this really is it. Like, this is maybe all you get. And you have to do something different. But even then, I was still paralyzed. I still felt like I couldn't make a change. And ironically, it was a Turkish proverb that gave me the permission to get out of medicine. And it was no matter how far you've gone down the wrong road, turn back. And I think that sentence alone, that mantra could help anyone who is in that position and who feels as though this is an impossible, it's an impossible decision. And there's just no way that I can change it because I have invested so much of my life, my identity, my finances. I mean, it was a massive, massive investment that seemed insurmountable.
This was I kind of like forced myself to stay in acupuncture until I paid back my student loans so that at least I used the job that I used the degree and the job to pay back the loans.
Well, you were a lot smarter than I was.
Well, I also probably had a lot lo less loans since I didn't have, 12 years of schooling behind me, just six. So, and then I did more because I'm
Because that's who we are.
because
Yes.
that's who we are. But, that it was one of the things that I that did hold me back was just my student loan numbers. I was like, well, I can't quit the job now. I'm still paying back the loans that I took to get this job. And that's also a sunk cost fallacy. I didn't need to do that. That doesn't even make any sense. But it was a rule that I made for myself somewhere along the lines that kept me in it, just slightly longer than I needed. All right. So that is, compassion fatigue. That is it's self-identification and how's been sunk cost fallacy. And now let's go to Moral injury. This is a term that is quite common in the medical world, right? We talk about this quite a bit in the medical world. We also talk about it a lot in nonprofits, which is one of the biggest spaces that I work in and keynote in. Let's talk about, but a lot of people, especially in the corporate world, they don't even know what this term means. They have not heard it before. Not because they're not smart, it's just not something that's talked about in this area. So when you say
Doesn't
moral
come up as much in the corporate world.
it does not come up as much in the corporate world, but I think that it should. So let's
Oh,
talk
it
about what
absolutely
it
should.
means.
Yeah, so in the context of medicine, moral injury really means that as a physician, I mean, you take an oath, you take a vow, and that is to serve patients and to heal and to, really do your best work in service of the patient and their well-being and their health and getting them, as close to health as possible, whether that's a life-saving treatment or a prescription or a visit or whatnot. But when you're prevented from doing that work, when the system and all of the obstacles that are put in place in front of physicians.
RE insurance.
Yeah, let's talk about insurance and prior authorizations and things and the paperwork and the EHRs and the, all of the things and the fact that you're cramming in 25 patients in a day, et cetera. All of those obstacles prevent you from delivering the care that you know that you should be delivering and that you want to give. And so that disconnect, that inability, that powerlessness, and that frustration, that actually kind of causes damage to your soul and who you are. And you feel almost, angry, devastated, resentful, frustrated, sad that you cannot be what you signed up to be as a physician. And that, and a lot of sources actually say that that is more so the cause of burnout in medicine and physicians than more traditional causes of burnout.
Yeah. So when you read really deep into the burnout research, you put the moral injury goes under a values mismatch. Like that's where it ends up fitting, right? Because you have a value that you cannot align with within the circumstances that you're in. So in the nonprofit space, this is somebody who, lived a certain life, had a certain trauma, had a certain experience, and decided to go into a nonprofit that supports people with that similar experience, only to realize that they can't do that because the government won't let them, because the nonprofit is siphoning money somewhere, because the leadership is, the board is preventing something from happening, because. Like this, your desire to help and to serve is broken up. But in the corporate space, this happens too. So as if you are a leader or an individual contributor listening right now and you're in the corporate space, this is what happens when you go work somewhere that has a set of values on the wall that you really agree with. And when you start working there, they are pretty much aligned and you're like, okay, we're doing this thing, we're doing this thing, we're doing this thing. And then as you dive deeper, you start to learn that the way that you think you're helping the world is not so helpful. The way that you're showing up for people is not benefiting them as much as your company would like you to believe. And this is a really hard thing to overcome. Moral injury is one of the reasons when I was still doing a lot of one-on-one coaching, moral injury and huge values mismatches is one of the things that I believe is not fixable within a workplace, and you've got to get out and change things. So back when FRIED was about individual recovery, I had quite a few physicians on that talked about the work that they're doing now, and most of them have left and opened private practices so that they can practice the way that they want to avoid this moral injury. They're not making as much money, they're not as protected, they're not in a hospital system, not everybody can get to them. They have to have sort of exclusive rates because otherwise they can't pay their astronomical student loan bills and their insurance payments, their malpractice insurance
Malpractice.
payments, right? So they have to charge as much as they charge just to survive. But they find a way to work slightly outside the system in order to be able to function. And I think that a lot of times, this is sort of one of the only options because you can't fix a values mismatch in a system that you don't control.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's worth mentioning that a lot of times the burden is shifted to the individual when it comes to solving or resolving burnout. And when moral injury is involved, there's no amount of meditating or yoga or, you know, wellness seminars that you can deliver in a workplace or attend that is going to fix that. That is a systemic problem. That is a problem that needs to be fixed by the healthcare system, by the insurance carriers, by just the way we do medicine today.
Yeah, I was listening to that. Somebody was on. It might have been an Instagram reel. I don't remember. A doctor talking about, might have been on Mel Robbins' podcast, but a doctor talking about how he saw a patient. They needed an antibiotic. He prescribed the antibiotic. He clicked whatever button he clicked next to the antibiotic. The patient goes to the pharmacy to pick up the medicine. The pharmacy says this isn't covered, and the patient's like, it's an antibiotic, how is it not? I have a bacterial infection and this is an antibiotic, like how is this
right.
not covered? This doesn't make
right.
sense. So then she had to go home without her medicine, call her doctor, and then her doctor had to spend an hour on the phone between the pharmacy and the insurance company to figure out, this is not what you are supposed to be spending your time on.
That's not what you sign on for.
Exactly.
When you decide to
but
become
only to
a
find
patient.
Out that he clicked the word capsule instead of tablet. And the insurance company only will give a tablet and not a capsule of the same medicine in the same dosage to the same patient.
Oh, I've been through this. And I've been through this as a mother as well of a child with a serious illness. And when the doctor prescribed a certain formulation of a medicine that was not covered, and they said, oh, you have to take, you know, this formulation. And she's like, that doesn't treat this condition. You can't. So there are people who lack education and experience who are gatekeeping and telling doctors what they can and can't do, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Yes.
I mean, I used to practice neurology, and I was an epileptologist, and oftentimes you would be trying to switch seizure medications for a patient, or you've been trying to prescribe a specific seizure medication, and they would say, well, they have to fail these other ones first.
I'm not doing that to my patient.
You're
Why
like,
do you do
so,
that?
excuse me, what?
Yeah.
You want this person to have seizures so they can get the correct medication. This is ridiculous. Or, you know, they would only prescribe the generic, and the generic has such a wide therapeutic window that you're like, no, this person actually needs this specific.
And I know
Do not
that
substitute.
because of my 12 years of training. And because I know this patient. And so, and this also happens. So this happens in the corporate world. This happens in medicine. This happens in police work, right? Like you can't gather the proper evidence against a crime, even though you know that it happened in the past, but you have to wait for them to do it again in order to be like, it's like,
Yeah, no, it's too much. And so, you know, you've got the intersection of all of these things. You've got the intersection of, you know, the nature of the job itself. I mean, it is a tough job. There's long hours, there's punishing hours, there's a lot of after hours work. There's all of the charting and all of that stuff that is just, it's really difficult. And then there's the fact of the work itself. I mean, you're dealing with human beings
At
who
their
are at their
worst, most
worst,
of the
at
time.
their worst moments in their life. And you're supposed to somehow kind of like absorb all of that. And I don't think we got any of the proper training
For that.
for trauma processing. None.
Yeah.
And when I would, you know, fall apart or be extremely upset after I had seen a very difficult patient, my staff, my attendings, my supervising residents, they'd just be like, what is wrong with you? And now I realize what was right with me. You know, I was just holding on to my humanity in a way that the system was telling me that I could not.
Yeah. And then
And
patients either think
that was
that
a
you are,
mismatch.
yeah, it's a mismatch, exactly. And patients either think that you're the devil or God, there and nothing in between. You're not a neutral character in their story. You are one or the other. And it's like, I remember when I was 17, I had a cyst, an ovarian cyst removed, and it was on my birthday. And I had been through, there was a lot of pain beforehand. We couldn't figure out what was going on. And just after my surgery, after I woke up, the doctor came in my room and looked at me and said, oh, good thing you came in when you did, because otherwise you probably would have gotten sepsis and died because that thing was ready to burst. I was 17.
Oh my God.
But this doctor sees this shit every day.
Wonderful bedside manner,
But
yeah.
this is the thing. This is what happens with compassion fatigue and moral injury and burnout, because you're not thinking about a
Absolutely.
17-year-old girl. You're just like, what? And in your mind, you might be like, this is great news. You made it.
Yeah.
Like, you did it.
Why are you upset? I'm
Yeah.
telling you
But I
something
was just sitting there
positive. You're
like,
like,
oh my God, I just
you.
almost died. Like, nobody told me that.
Yeah, and a way to create medical trauma in another human being too,
Like,
in a
whoa,
patient.
hey. So I think that those things, the things that you mentioned, I think that they, compassion fatigue and moral injury, are more prevalent in medicine. And I don't think that they're not existing in other places. And I think sometimes what we don't understand is that something like compassion fatigue, you can have in your life because of caretaking. You can have that because you have an ill child, or because you have a
Oh.
parent that you're taking care of, or because, and that will affect whether or not you burn out in your workplace. And your workplace might not even know that that's going on for you. Right?
Absolutely.
Like compassion fatigue can happen from all different things. Moral injury can happen from all different things. Like, if you feel like you are supposed to be doing something good and you planned your life to be able to support other people, and the system that you're working within does not allow you to act in that way. I mean, I think in the nonprofit world over the past year and a half now, where we're recording this, it's April 2026. And so since the beginning of 2025, the nonprofit world has been fighting for funds, right? Like, they all of their funding got pulled. Everything's been a disaster. How are you supposed to not have moral injury when the work that you've dedicated your life to, you just got told was useless and doesn't deserve any support?
Yeah.
And you're fighting every day just to be able to help people, but you are focused on lobbying and fundraising, not on actually doing the work of helping the people that you want to help. It's exhausting.
It is. And I think that as women, we tend to take on more of that burden and we tend to take it more personally than men, and we definitely see this bear out in the statistics in medicine in terms of the disparity among who burns out and at what rate. And there is a big difference between men and women in medicine. And it's quite fascinating research. You sort of think, like, well, I mean, why would it be different? Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, aside from just, our tendency to maybe be more empathic and to have things affect us more, maybe we're more prone to moral injury. Maybe we're more prone. Actually, men
Maybe
are
we're
quite
just
prone
talking about it.
to compassion fatigue as
Yeah.
well. They get really cynical. They get really cynical, and we get really burnt out. And they're more able to sort of keep going. But there's some other fascinating research about women physicians and the way we practice medicine and the expectations and that discrepancy. So women physicians spend more time per patient. They chart more. They have more after hours charting and messaging. So much more messaging back and forth. Patients message female physicians more. And they expect faster responses. And when they don't get those responses, they have a very negative opinion of that physician. Whereas if a male physician doesn't respond for 48 hours or 72 hours, oh, they must be
Busy.
busy. Right. And female physicians have much better health outcomes for their patients. This is across the boards. And we get paid a lot less. And we burn out more.
I'm so tired
So
just listening to that. So
make that math make sense.
exactly. So if there's a female physician who happened to fall onto this podcast this week and is like, okay, well, if all those things are true, then how can you possibly help me? Like, this system is broken. How am I going to feel better if I work with you? So can you talk a little bit about the work that you do and how that supports people?
Yeah. I would love to. So it is really tricky. And I don't tell people that, listen, I left medicine, but I'm that's not what I'm preaching necessarily. Like, if you work with me, you're going to quit your job and blow up your life. No. So everyone is different. Every situation is different. Every case of burnout, as you know, is unique. And I think that it really involves going deep with the individual and sorting out what their individual patterns are. So, what I like to do with folks is number one, recognition, awareness. You cannot address a problem if you're not aware of it and you don't recognize it as a problem. I mean, we went back in time and asked, former me in medicine, are you burned out? I would have said no. I don't think I didn't have the language. I didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't have the tools to recognize that. I just thought it was like adulting or, gee, I guess this is just what it's like to be a physician and this is what I signed on for. So I guess this is just my life now. And I think a lot of women just accept or in denial, just, well, this is my life now. Nothing can change. Now, I'm more than willing to help those folks to break out of that pattern and see that, there are ways, there are things that can shift and can change. And of course, there's the individual and all of the individual patterns that can shift and change. And those are within our control. And then there's the systemic factors and the institutional factors. And those we can't really change. I mean, they are changing. They change over time at a sort of Jurassic glacial
Racial.
pace. Yeah. So if you can't wait around for that, you can do everything you can as an individual. So that's where I come in and where I work with people. And I also help people recognize, do I need to change jobs? Do I need to change my role within my current position? Do I need to change positions? Do I need to leave this job at this institution or this company? Or do I need to change careers altogether? I mean, that's a pretty drastic one. That's the one I picked. And no regrets, zero regrets. I regret that I didn't do it sooner, but then I wouldn't have all the knowledge and experience and expertise that I have now and all the brain chemistry and nervous system knowledge that I have when I really help people learn to rewire, because I think a lot of women who burn out, we're perfectionists, we're overachievers. We live our lives in constant crisis, fight or flight, distress mode. We are always in survival mode. And that's all we know. And that is not sustainable over the long term. It may have gotten us here. It may have gotten you awards, accolades, success, amazing grades, Ivy League education, whatnot. It got you here, but it cannot get you there because you will burn out and you will develop autoimmune disease or other conditions. Trust me, I know. And so I help folks kind of rewire their nervous system, develop new practices, new habits, get new tools in their toolkit that are not going to fix everything, but at least you can fix your own regulation and your own sort of HPA axis that is so out of whack that is perpetuating this constant state of fear and burnout and survival mode, because stress can't really be your operating system.
And
We
people are
often
like,
rely
what
on
do
it.
you mean?
Yeah. What do you mean? But stress is so good. And I'm so addicted to it because I'm so used to it. And I think a lot of us are addicted to stress.
So here's a question that is sort of for my curiosity's sake, because this is something that I run into a lot with people that are neuroscientists or neurologists or people that have done a lot more like schooling or training than I have, but who got to the world of burnout and they were like, oh shit, I didn't know this stuff. So, what did you have to learn post burnout that you didn't learn as a neurologist that has been surprising to you and helpful to you? And like what were the gaps, even though you're a neurologist, like you're a neuro, yes,
Oh
you
my
treated
gosh.
epilepsy, so you weren't treating burnout, but still
No.
you had more information about the brain than 99.999% of the population, and yet still there were gaps. So can you talk about the things that you had to learn fresh on the other side?
So many gaps. So I think that where medicine in general fails, where medical education in general fails, and where perhaps Chinese medicine, other alternative medicine fields succeed is that we learn nothing about wellness and health. We only learn about disease and illness. We only learn about what is wrong. We don't learn about what is right. We don't learn preventative medicine. I mean, things are shifting, things are changing. I mean, we get maybe 1 hour of nutrition education. We get 1 hour maybe of menopause education. So we don't get any education on sort of stress and lifestyle and mental health. I mean, we learn about depression and schizophrenia and dementia and things that are like very discrete disease states, but we don't learn about like the everyday, what happens to your nervous system? What happens to your immune system? What happens to your cardiovascular and metabolic system when you are under constant stress and strain? We just don't learn about it. And we certainly don't learn about the differences between men and women and the hormonal aspect and what happens when you take a woman who's extremely successful, very high achieving, you put her in a very stressful career, and then you add perimenopause on top of that. I mean, that is literally, I call it the perfect storm because you've got all of the effects of fluctuating estrogen, lowered progesterone. You've got the impact on the HPA axis, and really you're kind of losing your stress buffer. And that is why the wheels really come off for women in midlife, where you're just like, I can't do this shit anymore. And I don't know why I used to be able to. Well, estrogen's partly why.
Yeah, there are literal biological reasons why. Like, this is, you're not making this up. This is a real thing.
So I had to relearn and learn all of that. And really, we don't learn a whole lot about trauma and the nervous system. I mean, we don't, let's be real, we don't learn anything. And about, the autonomic nervous system and about the vagus nerve and all of those things and how that all interconnects to form, our state, our homeostasis, our current mental, physical, emotional state, and how things that happen to you. I mean, childhood trauma is a major risk factor for burnout. And that was a shocker to me. I did not know that. And it makes so much sense because if you experience something traumatic as a child and your nervous system becomes wired for danger and for hypervigilance, and you're in this constant heightened state of fight or flight or freeze, you're in survival mode. I mean, you're already halfway to burnout and you haven't even gotten to high
You're
school.
seven.
You're seven. Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that is massive. And that's not something I think that many people realize and touch on. It's definitely something that I like to explore. I mean, not a trauma therapist, but I've had plenty in my life. And I think it's really overlooked. And I think women really, when they learn that it's kind of, it's not my fault. I think people blame themselves for burnout. What is wrong with me?
It's crazy.
Why am I weak? Why can't I do this? Why is everyone else able to do this job?
They
I mean, I
can't
would
eat.
ask myself that. Why is everyone else? They seem like they're just, how are they doing this? And they're just
They're not
fine.
fine. So this is something that I wrote about in my first book that came out. I wrote the book in 2018. It came out in 2020, and
Perfect timing.
I didn't write. I didn't realize that other people didn't know that, really. And so I was shocked by the response to it. And that's when I did, and I started the next degree, and that's what I wrote my final paper on, all the correlations between adverse childhood experiences and later chronic stress responses in the body and in the brain. And I got to the point within the last couple of years that I forgot that that wasn't common knowledge. And
It's not.
people are still like, what do you, well, and in addition to not knowing that piece, people also don't consider their childhoods to be traumatic even when they were.
Right, if it's not capital T trauma
Yeah. But sometimes even when it is.
and complex PTSD is complex for a reason,
Exactly.
and I think a lot of it is normalized,
Yeah.
and
Well, and
that for me
like,
anyway, that's what I was shocked
yeah.
when I was finally diagnosed, and I thought, well, it's impossible. I've never been in the army. I didn't go to Afghanistan. I've never been, physically or sexually, abused, and how could I have trauma? I don't.
Yeah.
And this doctor was like, oh girl, where
Yeah.
do I start with you? And then all the pieces suddenly started to come together and it all started to make sense. And I realized that, of course, I was setting myself up for burnout before I even started.
Setting yourself up. No, your life had set you up for
My life had,
right. Like
yes,
you
I
didn't
didn't
do
do it
anything.
on purpose.
Right. You
Didn't
didn't
do it
do
on purpose.
anything. This was really shocking to me because, my family now, we really enjoy each other, all of us. Like, we get my husband and some of my cousins' partners are always like, it is so weird how much you guys want to hang out with one another, how much time you spend together, even as cousins. They were like, we don't hang out with our cousins. Why do you hang out with your cousin? Like, my family at large is really close and tight-knit, and we show up for one another. Like, I'm sitting in my office right now, and the shades in my office were hand-stitched by my aunt and put up by, and she drove 3.5 hours to put them up in my windows because that's the kind of family I have, So I had a hard time admitting that my childhood could be traumatic because I love my family, and it felt like if I admitted that, then I was doing them a disservice because I didn't, I, even though I know the rules now, my father was an addict, blah, blah, blah. Because I know those things now and I understand the effects they had on me, I can sort of get through it. But at the time, I was like, yeah, but my parents did the best they could. Like, I know they did the best they could. I trust that they did the best they could. It's just how it was. And I grew up in a really downtrodden city where a lot of other people had it a lot worse than I did. So in my
Yeah,
mind, I
that
was like,
game of my, it's not that
it's
bad.
not
Other people have
that bad.
it worse. The trauma Olympics.
It's not that bad. And it doesn't, folks, it doesn't matter. That doesn't
And
matter.
it's just the interplay of like your nervous system and your genes
Yeah.
and your epigenetics and the things that happen to you. And then, different people might be exposed to the same thing and have a different outcome. And then when I think about like that, I set myself up for burnout. When I said that, I think what I meant was by choosing medicine. Like that was a choice that I made.
Yeah, but you couldn't have known.
Definitely the wrong choice. I couldn't have known, but it was propelled by childhood trauma, and I thought that was a really good reason.
Well, earlier when you said, because I'm a really big empath, to in me, in my head, as soon as somebody says that, my brain automatically goes, no, you're hypervigilant because of some shit.
Oh, yes,
Right?
Brené Brown. What is it? Brené Brown talks about how she has this had this superpower as a kid where she could always predict the future and what would happen. And that's just because of trauma and being hypervigilant and being able to read these like subliminal nonverbal cues and things and then and to know when people were going to
So
explode at her. So yeah, yes.
we covered
Totally,
childhood
totally.
trauma. We covered,
Combine honestly.
right? We've covered childhood trauma. We've covered compassion fatigue. We've covered moral injury. We've covered the sunk cost fallacy. I think that is plenty for one episode.
Girl, I could go on and on. We didn't even talk about how, like medical training is just so punishing. We talked about a little bit
A
about
little
just
bit, yeah.
the stats of how these, these bright-eyed med students show up and then the system really breaks you. It really breaks you down. And
Intentionally.
so we need to do better. We need to do better for our trainees. We need to do better for our physicians. We need to do better for our women physicians, especially
We need an
because
entirely new healthcare system and new insurance plans in this country.
we can't afford, well, because the pipeline for medicine, more and more, it's now majority, vast majority women. are going into medicine because men realize this is a terrible career. And what there was some one study I came across that said that 12% of physicians would recommend the career to others and to their children. 12%. So that's not great.
That's not
And so the pipeline for medicine is women, and yet women are disproportionately burning out in medicine and leaving medicine, then we don't have a really solid foundation for a future. And we can't afford to be losing these physicians to, mental health, to suicide, to early retirement, to just leaving the profession in droves. And so it's a real wake-up call, I think, for the profession as a whole, for, institutions, for associations to really stand up for their physicians and say, like, okay,
We got to do better.
we need a better system.
All right, Dr. Zaria, where should people find you and the podcast and all the things?
Yes. Yeah, so I do a podcast. It's called Outsmart Burnout. You can find it on all the podcast platforms. I have amazing guests like Kate, who's going to be on the podcast in the next season, which is coming up. It's launching season four, launching in May. So tune into that for sure. It's a really fun podcast and we talk about all things burnout. I also have a website, which is drzaria.com. You can come hang out with me on Instagram at Dr. Zaria Rubin. And I would love to speak at your next event, whether it's a podcast or a conference or a workshop. I love to work with organizations, with women's organizations, with women's empowerment groups, and also, medicine, obviously. I've spoken at a lot of medical schools, to trainees, even to pre-med students. And this gives me a lot of hope for the future, actually, because a group of pre-med students hired me at UCLA. And I thought to myself, wow. And these kids knew what compassion fatigue was, and they knew other terminology. I thought, okay, this generation, I have hope now. If they are starting this, and I know I'm digressing, but I have to tell you one more thing. I teach at my daughter's school. She's in middle school. And I showed up at the school yesterday and I was waiting on the landing because the lesson was wrapping up. And it was a health lesson about, like, they're doing health class routines and stuff. And they were talking about sexuality and stuff. And I hear her mention burnout as a factor in mental health and wellness and even sexual health for teens. And my jaw fell on the floor. And I actually went up to the teacher after and I said, I am so impressed. I mean, I didn't learn about burnout in high school, college, middle school, high school, college, medical school, none of it. You guys are talking about this in middle school? I'm so impressed. It was very, very hopeful for the
I
future.
love
So,
it. All right,
yeah.
Frag fam. All of those links, as per usual, will be in the show notes so that you don't have to remember them or look for them or find them. They will be readily available for you. If you loved this episode, please feel free to share it with everyone that you think could need it. And that person that you should be sharing it with, their name probably popped up in your head a couple of times while we were talking. If that happened, go right now, click the share button, send them the link. And then if you'd love to, we'd love to have you leave a review for the podcast because that is how the podcast grows and reaches more people so that we can quote unquote hashtag end burnout culture together. Thank you so much, and until next time.